Let's kick off. Thank you, everybody. So if you haven't realized the session you are, there it is. And just a warning a little bit. So Mandy and I know each other for over 20 years now, and it can get a little bit philosophical. If it does, please don't leave the room. It can get better. So ask a question and get us back on track. This whole presentation came about, and that explains why you can get philosophical as well, came about over a glass of wine at Mandy's place a few months ago. And it was really a very simple question that Mandy asked me. So she, and you probably had that the same experience, she asked me, so you say you're an enterprise architect, what does that mean? And we started talking about what it meant to me as an enterprise architect, and then she started asking questions on, so do you have XYZ problems? Yep. Oh, interesting. How do you solve them? This way. Same here. And then she said, what about XYZ? So this talk is our view of three main things that we thought we could discuss with you. And we're happy to take questions. If we start running out of time, we'll just push through, but we will be over at the hub at lunchtime. If you want to carry on with the philosophical questions, we're more than happy to have lunch with you guys.
Paolo asked me to at least introduce you a little bit to my background. I started my career over in Los Angeles working for an architect called Eric Owen Moss. He was one of a group of three or four architects at the time who were really trying to break open the whole notion of what constitutes architecture. And Eric had this thing he called the hole in the sky theory. He basically argued that the role of architecture was to break holes in our sky. Skies being all those things that limit us and basically predetermine what we're able to do. So he said, fundamentally, the role of an architect was to open up, break spaces forward so we can actually do things that we couldn't have done before. So I was over in Los Angeles for about 5 years. I then came back and did a PhD, essentially trying to follow that notion of how do you study a situation in advance of doing architecture in order to, rather than determining what or justifying what we do in architecture, trying to actually say we're going to look really hard at the situation and find out what other options there are. And that led me fundamentally into reading one heck of a lot of philosophy. So Paolo's told me, cut the philosophy out, but every so often I'll sneak it in and you might not even know.
Right, so which brings us to the first tip. You need to know what architecture is. And I bet most of the people in the room got into a situation where you might be in a project and maybe half of the people, maybe because of they are representing the business, or in my case, project managers, they accept the fact that somebody said that they needed to have an architect in the project, but they have no idea what to do or why you should be there, right? Usually you are the guy that is asking questions that are just putting roadblocks, those difficult ones that, oh, no, come on, why are we getting there? We know what the solution is, and you know that the solution that they're proposing is really suboptimal at best. So tip number one, you need to know what architecture is, and you need to be able to articulate that at least to a level that people will be comfortable that you're in the room and you have something to contribute to. Because if you don't, you know, they won't pay attention, they won't understand why it's taking so long, and if you're lucky, your contribution is going to be acknowledged and thanked just at the end. Assume you did your job well.
I don't know whether you find in the IT industry that people are accusing you as an architect of always making things more complicated.
Oh, yes.
We find in the field of architecture that whole process of looking at the situation, saying every time there's a minor change that's about to happen, you go, hang on, minor change, I need to actually assess all of the consequences of that minor change. At which point everybody in the room groans and go, bloody architects, excuse my language again, bloody architects, you're causing trouble again. et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one situation that happens in the building industry all the time, which I think Paolo's pretty much said that happens with you guys all the time. The other thing is when you've actually worked on a project forever and you finally realize this project is utterly exquisite. You've just nailed it. And at that point, it's simpler and clearer than you've ever thought before. And it's just got this sort of quality of its own. It just sort of feels right. And at that point, you go to your client and you present this project and you describe, and it looks so simple, they can't understand why you hadn't come up with that at the first moment. So this is sort of where we're getting to. It's like we're basically, what is really the cover of the whole presentation today is this: how do you actually let people know what the act of architecture is? So Paolo essentially came to me and sort of said, you know, out of the building industry's gone on for thousands of years, can you give us three tips that we can take away? So that's what we're really doing. Number one is we need to figure out a way to describe what architecture is so that at any point when people are dealing with those sorts of issues of it's just suddenly got so simple, why wasn't always that simple, or why are you making things so complicated, you've actually got a way of describing, right at this moment the act of architecture has taken place. And that's what you're paying for. So
you know, have you had that experience before where you finally nailed and it feels good and you're looking at the diagram or the high level architecture or some description of the project and I think I'm ready now, right? Anybody? Okay. So Mandy, over that glass of wine, she came and described to me what she thought the act of architecture was or what the role of the architect was. So that picture represents two things to me, and that's how I interpret what Mandy was talking about. Number one is most of the time, you are dumped into a project or in a situation or in an organization, especially if you're an enterprise architect starting into a new organization, and that's how you feel. How the heck did I get here, and what am I going to do with all this junk? So you're in that clearing, you have no idea what the background is, what are these things you need to work with, and how can you get value out of it? But also the fact that the role of the architect is to look at the clearing, to understand what is the environment where you're going to do your work, what are the things that can impact on what you need to do, but also how are you going to impact what is around you. So managing the clearing, creating the clearing, understanding the clearing, for me, is what the architect does. And then from there, everything flows. Your work flows well. You understand the elements. A key thing that we need to remember is you need to get out of the clearing as well and look from a distance, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that later on, but look from a distance and see what you're dealing with. By staying in the clearing, there's quite a lot of problems that can affect the act of architect, the work that you're doing. So you need to get out of that as well.
So one of the reasons I was talking to Paolo about the idea of a clearing is just really to get to this process of understanding that what we're doing as architects is creating a space where some things can happen and not others. Now, often we go into an environment and things are already happening. That's really the junk that Paolo's talking about. What we're looking for is essentially proper relationships between things. We say architects are interested in propriety, proper relations. The interesting thing is that actually when things already have proper relationships between things, there's no role for an architect. That's not when we do architecture. When we do architecture is when proper relationships have broken down. And as an example, this is the site, I don't know whether any of you have been there, to the Queen Elizabeth Olympic Park in London. One of the things that was going on there is there was a clearing, there was a situation where essentially London was divided in two parts by this river. So there was an environment on one side, an environment on the other, and then there was this river and a sort of wasteland, industrial wasteland all around it. Fundamentally, there was a problem. There were not proper relationships between these two parts of London. So essentially, they generated this site as the Olympic Park, almost as a temporary condition, so that later on, this park would stitch the two parts of London together. So what they were doing is essentially creating a new clearing whereby the two parts of London could start to actually come back together and face each other and share this in-between space. They were making things possible that had not been possible before. So if you keep that in the back of your mind, we're creating a clearing where some things are possible that could not have happened before. If you imagine as a forest, chop down a few trees, suddenly some things can happen but not others. And if you always imagine what you're doing that way as choosing which things to take out, which things to leave, then you get a sense of that's the role of the architect.
So thing to remember as well in terms of the clearing and the fact that if the elements have already well-defined relationships, especially in IT. Yes, it becomes a technical problem now of stringing these things together, but your role is to make sure that that's not getting out of hand as well. So projects can get out of hand when you agree on a particular direction, the relationships are defined, you hand over to the designers or to the implementers, and you step back, and when you look at the final result, it went in a completely different direction. So you need to keep them moving in the right way.
One of the key things from the last slide was this understanding that, in fact, as architects, we're always dealing with this thing to do with uncertainty. So this is one of these things I sort of said to Paolo and go, you know, as an architect, everything we do, we're looking for those places of uncertainty where things aren't clear, because that's where we get to do architecture. If we can't find uncertainty, somebody else can do it. It can be done incredibly well by a technician who has all the expertise. It's only when there's uncertainty that architects are necessary. And I think your response was to me was, holy friggin' moly, you know, none of our clients are going to like this uncertainty notion. You know, they'll be really unhappy. You have to fake that you're certain even when you know you're actually dealing with uncertainty. And that's when, you know, and Paolo thought I was joking, I said, that's why architects wear black. Now, I mean, this is sort of one of the jokes in the architecture industry of why we wear black, but fundamentally, it's this notion that dealing with uncertainty is not what people like. You're supposed to be an expert. You're supposed to know what you're doing. And any time you say, my field is always where I don't know, I'm looking for opportunities of not knowing, people freak out. So the idea of wearing black is simply that you put on black, you go, I'm going to handle that uncertainty with care and a little bit of finesse, I suppose. So another reason, I think we were talking about that this morning, is, you know, when I Google why do architects wear black, just as a background, it's because we're so sick of making decisions that at least you can get up in the morning and not have to decide.
So a key thing for your customers, and Jim McCarthy, old Microsoft product manager in 1995 days, he used to say that your clients can either hire somebody that will lie to them, or they can hire somebody that's going to deal with uncertainty and say, I don't know, but I'll tell you as soon as I find out. It's their option. Our role as architects is to provide some level of confidence that even when you don't say no, you're going to take them in the right direction. So tip number three is actually the title of the presentation, and the witch, the wardrobe, and the lion, or the lion, the witch, no, the echo chamber, the straitjacket, and the F word. And that came out, that was basically where we got to after the second glass of wine. And this picture here is, in a way, a representation for me of people getting out of their comfort zone, looking for ways of delivering something that, in my opinion, still looks ugly, but is fantastically functional. And when you, if you Google that, is the Habitat in Montreal, it is brilliant. It looks ugly, but it's brilliant. And the environment that the guy created and the actual apartments underneath, they just so functional that it's not funny, right? But still ugly. So it's the balance between the subjectivity of being beautiful or being ugly versus the functionality and what you're working with to deliver the value that has been asked from you. So Google it is really, really interesting. So if you get to the first one.
So the idea of the echo chamber came up initially in the media industry. If you can stare at this slide and imagine that basically a journalist would go out into a war zone have a look at what was going on, take a few pictures, essentially send all that information back to the bunch of other journalists who are sitting around in their chairs in the office. They listen to this information, they make up their own story, they then publish those stories or various versions of them, and funnily enough, all of the other stories that get told seem to confirm whatever they've said. So you've got one source that's coming in, you've got a whole lot of people essentially saying or using the same story without actually having any ability or even checking the information that they get. And what we start to realize is that even the information that comes in is affected by the box that everybody's sitting in. So in the media industry, everybody knows that they'll get paid a hell of a lot for some types of stories and some types of photographs and some types of information, but not others. What we're trying to do is try and get you to think about what's happening in the media industry and actually see that it happens in just about every single discipline you end up in. There's a sort of confirmation of what people will accept as true. And people get so used to hearing the same thing, and everybody's read this, you know, Googled the same gurus or read the same books, etc. So the same sort of information gets round and round and round. And what we find is a lot of terminology that we use gets bounced round and round and round without anybody checking again. Because so many terms get developed for one situation, perfect for that situation, but we find 1 year or 2 years later the same terms are being used, but the situation has been changed. And we forget to understand that every term is somehow bound to its situation. If we don't go back and check that situation, we get ourselves into all sorts of problems. So that's the echo chamber. We're trying to understand that, you know, one of our roles is trying to understand the echo chamber that we're in whenever we're about to do a piece of architecture.
So this is how I feel in a particular meeting, or very often. And recently, you know, we got asked, what are we doing about the cloud? Okay, replace cloud with any favorite term of the day. What are we doing about big data? What are we doing about mobility? What are we doing about the conversion of mobility, cloud, advanced analytics? Who said that that's what I need to do? I'm not saying that is invalid, but those concepts are coming to our world, and you end up discussing those concepts rather than looking for the problem that you're actually trying to solve. So you're looking for ways of applying the concept, applying the latest trend that one of your favorite analysts has been banging on for the last 6 months, that you, and saying that you have to be aware of and you need to address it, because if you don't address it, you're going to lose your job. I'm going to address it, and I'm going to make sure that everybody around me knows that that particular trend is the most important thing we need to deal with, even though I'm carrying enormous technical debt that I need to deal with a legacy system that nobody knows how to manage anymore. I still need to talk about the cloud and dynamic analytics or advanced analytics and mobility and everything else, because everybody's talking about it. So if I don't talk about it, I'm not a good architect anymore. So we're feeding ourselves the terms, the jargon, the hype, and that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy on things that we do. So be really, really aware of the echo chamber, and you need to find a way of breaking it at some stage.
For us, and I'm sure you've been aware if you're reading the news, the issue of the housing crisis is a big deal in building architecture, and the word that we could easily slot into these slots is the word apartment. So pretty much people are going, apartment, 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 solution to everything. What we forget, and I assume is the same in your industry, that the cloud or the apartment might be a partial solution to a situation, but because there's a complete word in itself, people start to take it out and think it is the solution. So what we're really looking at is terms are dangerous. Always understand that you've got a bigger situation, you've got other parts to the solution, and sometimes we have to be careful that this terminology is broken down. A divider is put in at the limit of where the cloud is and whatever else is going on, in the same way there's a divider put in at the perimeter of an apartment. And we forget that apartments are dependent on cities or restaurants or cheap food or laundromats essentially being at the base, and all of these other social infrastructure, which is essential to the notion of apartment, which is when people are being put in very small situations. I don't know whether any of you saw the movie Doubt. It's probably 10 years ago now. It doesn't really matter whether you've seen it, but this was this fantastic scene of a priest basically saying to a woman, go up to the top of your apartment building, take a pillow, slice it open, and let the wind take all the feathers away. And so he then said, then I want you to go back down to the bottom of your building and try and collect all those feathers up. It seems a really potent image to start thinking of, if we don't break down those terms like apartment and clouds and check some of these things, and we leave them unchecked, they essentially go out into our whole discipline, our whole world. People keep on parroting the word cloud out there without actually saying that we need to check that and people need to understand what those terms actually mean. So what we're essentially saying that unchecked parroting is just like gossip. It's like a small lie that's going out there that people think is the answer. And we as architects have a role to essentially stop this echoing. We are the ones who essentially come in and go, what does this word really mean? And is it a complete solution or is it just a partial solution?
So boardroom situation, when you're talking to the execs as an enterprise architect, that comes to you all the time. So my example before, what are we doing about the cloud? What are we going to do with advanced analytics? What is our strategy for mobility? You need to dismantle that. You need to then make sure that you're thinking out of the box, but you're also taking them out of the box that they were put in by an analyst or vendor demonstration that finally showed that cloud is the best thing that they can ever do and will solve all their problems. Advanced analytics, if they are not doing, they don't know what their business is doing. So you need to bring them out of that box. You need to, as an architect, change the conversation a little bit and make sure that they fully understand the problem they're dealing with, but also the concept, that single word that you're trying to dismantle or trying to debunk.
So Paolo then asked me to say, have you got any tools or specific examples of how you do this in architecture? And at this point, I'm going to go a little bit obscure. What you're essentially trying to do is question your thinking. And to do that is really, really hard because we like to know what we're talking about and we like to have knowledge. It's a really comfortable thing whenever you go into a difficult situation. However, that comfortable knowledge or that, you know, sense of being an expert has to actually be undone every so often. So we would teach architectural students. There's one particular example where I got them to do. I basically asked them to go out and take a photograph of something that they found unbelievably ugly. So that was the starting point. So off they'd go and sort of find this. So one student came back with this picture of a piece of raw steak which had an unusual amount of veins of fat going through it. So that was number one. She just sort of put this photograph and everybody looked, oh my God, it's disgusting. So that was number one. And another person had a photograph, I remember, of a bunch of orange peelings that had been left on a table and had gone slightly moldy and were all curling up. First exercise brings something that everybody agreed, yeah, that's unbelievably ugly. The second exercise is like, okay, go off now and I want you to bring me back one photograph that turns what you just showed me from ugly into beautiful. How can you actually flip yourself to see it as the exact opposite? So the first student went off and brought back a photograph from the air of the tributaries of rivers in Christchurch going across the Canterbury Plains. And basically she said, I cannot now not see those veins of fat running through this raw steak in exactly the same way as those tributaries. Aren't they incredibly beautiful? Essentially, what I was trying to show her is that, in fact, the situation had changed. You were no longer seeing this steak as something that you didn't like fat, or you were on a diet, or it was raw, and you know, et cetera, et cetera. It was understanding that what we see is always tied to the situation. Similar thing went on with the orange peelings, et cetera, and she showed me a sort of photograph of a rose that had dropped its petals, and they actually curled up exactly the same way as the you know, moldy orange peelings. So what we're looking for is actually put in some tools. You sometimes have to try and force yourself to think the exact opposite and see if it's possible, and see to what degree what you think or the truth is tied into the situation. This is me again, right? So this one, Paolo and I went back and forward quite a bit. So there's this notion of the straitjacket. Having established what our problem is and tried to understand our problem a little bit better, we end up coming up with solutions. Now, we like solutions. At that point, we've finished our project to some degree. You come up with a solution, but typically you'll come up with three or four solutions, three or four options that cover all sorts of different ideas. In architecture, what we're actually trying to do is, rather than take the best solution and make it better, what we're looking for all the time is to say, how is it possible to enable all of these solutions to exist simultaneously with only the most small amount of modification? So if we don't, and we just take the best solution and we make it better, essentially what we're doing is buckling on a straitjacket. That is the only way that we can be into the future. Now, in architecture or building architecture, you can imagine that happens all the time, right? It's pretty friggin' expensive to build a large commercial project. And if a business has actually set itself up to need the project to be in that way, essentially the second you build it exactly perfectly for how they are now, you're creating a straitjacket. What you really need to do is think of all of the possible, slightly unlikely options, and think about how you can generate a scheme where even the most minor modifications can enable all of those possible options to be able to be done in the future, if in fact they might appear.
So for me, one of the key elements of my straitjacket, or and probably yours as well in your organization, is that idea of technical debt. So you are put into your organization, you have all that junk around you, you have those tools that have been there since ages, all those systems, and all you can do is deal with them. You have to work and do your job within the constraints of what you have or what you can do or what your customer can see in the next 2 or 3 years. However, if you just do that, you're just going to do an incremental change, and disruption in our industry is coming from all over the place. Those that are disrupting are those that are not working within the echo chamber or are subject to the straitjacket. They are completely thinking outside the box, and they're completely ignoring the constraints they have. So as architects in organizations, you have to deal with those constraints. So how do you architect for those all possible options? One tool that it's helpful is if you look at the hype cycle, for example. Most organizations want to deal with the certainty, which is, if you know Gartner hype cycle, is the technologies, they are well established. And you hear all the time, oh, we are not a leading edge organization, we are just the current version plus one or minus one, not the current version or even the current version plus one. So we are already in that straitjacket. How are you going to architect for the uncertainty and the all possible options? Is look at what is, for example, Forrester Wave or Gartner hype cycle saying on the steep side going up in terms of trends and technologies. How are you going to prepare your current solution to be able to either be modified or take advantage of those other options that are being made available? I had at work dealing with a reasonably large request for information where most of the responses were, you know, what you can do today. And the customer was, part of the customers, internal customers at least, were looking at that and said, yeah, but that's going to give me an incremental change. How can I get a solution from these vendors that is actually maybe 2 years in the future in terms of what I will be able to do? What's coming in terms of trends? If you think of customer service, for example, how to deal with social is already a known factor. How many of the traditional vendors, if you think utilities, if you think or more traditional manufacturing industries, how many of those are actually thinking of social as an element of their solution for customer relationship management, for example? So there's no ideal answer, but as an architect, you need to see how you're going to enable those trends coming forward to be realized out of the current solution you're putting in. How can you prepare the way for that? So that's basically the one of the elements of trying to remove the straitjacket and prepare for the future.
Maybe try another architectural example. Right at the very basic level of designing a house, you all live in houses. I just recently designed a house for my family, you know. Husband, wife, two teenage kids, you design a house, you say, you know, they're gonna make noise in the future, etc. How do you divide it up? You can design the perfect house for that situation, but actually what I ask myself is what could go on in the future? What are the other options? There might be a situation where they move completely out, we've got this enormous house, how do you close it off to handle that situation? How do you handle a situation where suddenly we're in financial crisis and we need half of the house to function as an Airbnb? How do we handle a situation where actually the kids want to stay forever and you've now got, you know, them and their partners, etc. How do you design a house for two couples now, potentially, who don't get on or do get on? What are all of these potential situations? And how can you design the capacity for this house to do minor modifications? Can you put in a door that can be locked and essentially divide the house into two houses so people don't ever see each other? Can you devise a situation where the laundry can easily be converted into a kitchen just by doing the most minor thing and suddenly turn it into two houses? What are the situations, where are they? You just really want to go through all of those options and try out how the thing works and figure out whether or not there's minor modifications can be. I think a lot of what you've been talking to me about, Paolo, is the situation of when do you dump a whole IT system and have to get a new one? And if we're thinking into the future, you really want to make whatever system you're creating able to just put in minor modifications to let whole other approaches that a business might go in be possible. So avoid the straitjacket.
And then you get into the echo chamber because, you know, VMware would tell you that I have the solution for you. Forget about cloud. You're talking about microservices now and containers and everything else. So you're back into the same problem. But here's, for me, a key element of avoiding the straitjacket is Mindy and I were talking about. You need to become less educated on your specific field and, you know, broaden your horizon. With that, we'll give you some other perspectives. From an organizational IT architecture point of view is when you see a solution architect going into enterprise architecture world. You're familiar with the T model where you have breadth versus depth of knowledge in a particular subject. You can think of a V as well, where you have multiple deep knowledge in subjects, but you actually broad. So that's when you need to take advantage of that breadth and expand it as much as you can to try to look for opportunities outside your normal field of work. If you're working in utilities, what is Air New Zealand doing? What is Fonterra doing? If you work in Fonterra, what is a Xero doing, for example, in terms of managing their customers? What can you do? So get out of your box, get out of your field of expertise, become less educated in there, and expand your horizons.
I feel I should credit the philosopher here, and I know, you know, Paolo's not really happy about me, but the interesting thing here is it was a guy called, I'm sure you've heard of Nietzsche. One of the things he talked about was how do you get to be Superman, as in more than man? How do you get to be more than what we are at the moment? You essentially have to question the obviousness of what we already know, because it's only by clearing that stuff away or ending up becoming a beginner again that you actually strive to know more. So it's a really important thing. If you can leave that in the back of your mind all the time, is actually expertise or what we currently know fills us up. It basically says every time we've got a solution, we're going to cut and paste that solution. It worked blinking well before, we're going to put it in here again. So unbelievably tempting. The challenge is really, and when we keep on coming back to, is the active architecture doesn't have to take place everywhere. So we don't have to become less experts everywhere, but we've got to look for those key moments where actually being an expert is not good. And it's usually the core, most potent piece of a project. Right at that point, you go back to basics. You go, I'm a complete beginner again. Only then can you become Superman and become more than, in fact, you currently think is possible.
And the danger of doing that in the context of your customers is to do that and still create that facade of certainty, because they will go and buy certainty from somewhere else if you make that too explicit. But that's a key component of what we need to do. Now, the next one is has become, in the last, 4 weeks since we started preparing for this, our favorite one. I have been using it almost every day at work. When you pick up the fact that you're in a conversation, you are constrained by the straitjacket, you are in an echo chamber, and you feel that there is no way out, and you say, fine. You created so much trouble, that is not funny, which is another F word. So Mandy and I, since we started talking, we started picking ourselves saying that all the time and getting, really annoyed with that. Said, no, I can't say that anymore. And trying to replace fine with different words just to avoid the problem. But the thing is, when you use fine, you are making a compromise. You're saying, yeah, my architecture was supposed to be really good and beautiful and simple, but because of all the other constraints, because of the way this is going, I will compromise and I'll say, fine. You want the cloud for this core system that is highly affected by privacy elements or protected information, and you say, fine. It's not going to be fine. The moment you say fine in our industry, you're creating huge technical debt. So a good architecture rather than an excellent architecture is more than fine. You are designing for uncertainty. You're designing for the various options, I hope. So it's not fine. You don't see yourself saying fine. When you say, she'll be right, or fine, that's when we're going to get into really, really, really deep problems.
I don't know about you guys, but one of the things that happens in the building industry is we say fine, and then we think we can sneak in architecture later. You know, it's like, yeah, fine. It's like, I know I'm clever enough. I know I'm innovative enough. They'll never notice if I go in and sort of, patch it up and make something beautiful or something great in the background. The danger, I guess, of when you do that is the F word does grow. The fine word essentially builds on each other. They keep on talking about the thing you said fine, and suddenly you're ending up doing another fine later on, and you're sort of essentially living in fine land where you're so busy doing architecture and hiding, you essentially can't keep up. So this notion of one F word leads to the other is almost we have to get a solution because it's so tempting. And Paolo's absolutely right. I was doing a project yesterday where, honestly, I'm on the phone and the whole time I know any minute I'm gonna say fine again. Fine, it'll be fine. Okay, fine. Oh, fucking heck, fine then. It's just this whole sense of, you know that there's a problem. I'll say fine because it's just too exhausting. But in the background, the second I put down the phone, back I go. Busy working, till 12 o'clock at night, fixing the fine. So be careful of the fine word.
And then I ask Mandy, what can we do to try to avoid the fine in fine land?
Just before we get to that, there's this one that's really, really important. Every time you say fine, you're not saying yes to a whole lot of other stuff. There's a whole package of, you have to be aware of the other. What are you saying no to by saying fine now? And we know sometimes there's this whole set of good ideas which are just sitting around in the background. When you say fine, you know they're there, but fundamentally by saying fine, you're saying no to everything else. And this is another philosophy behind all of this, a guy called Emmanuel Levinas, and he basically talks about this responsibility that we have to the other. all those other possibilities. And fine basically stops taking responsibility for all those other possibilities. It doesn't let them have a shoo-in. Doesn't even let them to speak to you or give you a little, you know, teasers or tiny weeny bits of those. By saying fine, you've closed off all the options to other, hopefully better possibilities. So then there's the question of how do we get out of this? So in architecture, we'll often, I don't know whether you guys have ever been in an architect's office, but particularly in the past, and this is probably 10, 20 years ago, you'd go in there and you'd find models everywhere. One of the things that we tried to do is always create a field of solutions, so that in fact you deliberately, in the early periods of developing solutions, you try and say, I'm not trying to get to the solution, I'm just trying to get to the rough area of the solution. So you'd build models of things you were and you weren't doing, just so that they could all be laid out in front of you. And essentially, Emmanuel Levinas used to talk about, as a philosopher, he'd say, you can't ever rationally deal with all of the other possible solutions. All you can do is be fundamentally open to them and have some sort of, he talked about dialogue with it in a sort of rhapsodical way, which I sort of summarized down as a sort of a dance. Be open to those other things, try not to close it down. So the fundamental issue here is for architects, one of our strengths is uncertainty. The longer we can keep uncertainty there, it means you're still speaking to other solutions. So obviously we're gradually going to close that uncertainty down. But what we're actually doing, when you're thinking about, am I actually creating architecture here? The second you have an immediate solution to a problem, a cut and paste, which is your expertise coming in, go, that's the solution, it worked last time. Fundamentally, you're not providing a service. You're clearly providing a service to somebody because you've got a quick answer. But what we would argue is you're not actually creating an act of architecture at the moment. That is not when architecture is happening. The act of architecture doesn't happen every single day, but we should be striving for it. And you can only do architecture when you've kept that notion of uncertainty open as long as possible. And this in our field is one of the ways we do it. I'm not quite sure how you would do a similar level of multiple models.
The thing about not turning your back on the other goes back to, you know, what you're saying no to. In IT, we know every time we say fine, what we're saying no to. Because we have put the alternative solutions together. We have considered them. If we're doing architecture, we're trying to look at everything that we could do to solve that particular problem and put a solution in place. So what you're saying no to is probably the key element for us in IT when we are working, especially in the early phases of each one of the projects. So the top three, we came up with a top three for us in terms of the straitjacket and the echo chamber and the fine word, F word. So the first one is related to what we're talking about in saying what is saying no to. So you need to do architecture on the problem, not the solution. As Mandy is saying, if you're working just on a particular solution and you're going deep into your expertise, you are providing a service, but what are you missing? What is outside the clearing? What is next door? What are the other elements that you should have considered for that solution? What are the other trends that you're not taking into account and you're closing the door to if you go in a particular way?
Essentially, each one of these is a reminder of what is it that we're doing as architects? What is architecture? Architects do work on the situation, not just the problem. So if you find yourself, there's a problem presents itself, you've got an immediate solution, an act of architecture hasn't taken place. As soon as you start to look outside at the situation, to even check whether the problem is really a problem in the first place, you're starting to enter the realm of architecture. So again, that's a really useful thing to say to your clients. When you're taking so long, what you're doing is actually going back and checking that the problem is really the problem that you want to solve. Number one. Number two is essentially become less rather than more educated in existing knowledge. Every time you've taken a pre-existing solution and you apply it to a problem, essentially there's no requirement for the act of architecture. That's not when architecture is taking place. In all these cases, it's not that you're not providing a service, right? And during your day, there will be enormous number of situations where you just can't undo and become not an expert at everything. But what we're looking for, the act of architecture takes place when you actually become completely uncertain. There is not a predetermined answer. We're actually in a situation where nothing has been done like this before, and we're leaping out into the unknown. But because of that, our way of working, or our way of thinking, or our ability to be comfortable with uncertainty, then in fact we are practicing and we're acting as an architect.
And as an enterprise architect rather than a solution architect, I think that my responsibility is to provide insight to my internal customer, or if I'm a consultant, to my paying customer. And the only way I can guarantee that I have at least a little bit of insight is if I'm considering things outside my domain of expertise. I will feel uncertain, and I believe that by doing that, I will be able to deal with that uncertainty I'm feeling, look for a way out of that to provide a nice, elegant solution to the problem that takes other things into consideration as well. So I need to go back to my T and keep expanding it to as much as I can. Look at philosophy, look at winemaking, look at milk sharing, and I'm working in water utilities. What else can I bring to the table that extends my experience and therefore allows me to deal with my situation better than just dealing with the solution and the problem?
And then the final one is just don't turn your back on the other for as long as possible. Continually think there is other things which should be talking to you in a sort of rhapsodic dance, giving you just these little prompts all the time. So you want to keep yourself open to those others. And it's literally that. It's basically going out and chatting to people from completely different industries to see if what they have actually told you about a completely different topic can shed light on what you're actually doing at the moment. And you'll find those things in the most unusual places. You know, I know it sounds bizarre, and this is really exposing what an architect is, but we'll look at a carpet pattern and suddenly go, ah, is that a solution? I'm actually shifting from this idea to look at the carpet pattern and see if it'll solve my family problems and how I should design a house. It sounds bizarre, but you would be surprised how often it will actually question what you're doing.
And because I like to expand the scope, there's a fourth. Thank you.
Thank you very much.